Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi tenders his resignation, paving the way for fresh elections and opening a new chapter of political uncertainty. The Kremlin says Western sanctions imposed on Russia over its war in Ukraine will not make it change course. And Iraq holds a day of national mourning for 9 people killed in the bombardment of a Kurdish village that the government blames on Turkey. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi has stepped down, paving the way for snap elections that could take place later this year.
In light of the vote expressed yesterday evening by the Senate, I'm asking to suspend the session because I'm going to meet the President to inform him of my intentions.
Draghi won the Wednesday vote of confidence in the Senate. However, 3 coalition parties withdrew their support for his government and did not take part. Last week, the Italian Prime Minister tendered his resignation also. He did so after the Five Star Movement refused to back him in a confidence vote on measures tackling the high cost of living. But President Sergio Mattarella rejected the resignation. He told Draghi to go before Parliament to see that if he could keep the broad coalition going. Draghi began his term in February of last year. With his departure, the President can now dissolve Parliament and trigger snap elections. Draghi is expected to act as a caretaker until elections are held. A correspondent in Rome, Max Civilli, joined us earlier with more details on the latest political developments in Italy. He says that there have been mixed reactions to Draghi's resignation.
Everything changed yesterday when the resigning Prime Minister held a speech in the Senate, which was as uncompromising as it was defiant and dismissive of some of the parties, namely the Five Star Movement and the League. The speech also included plans to introduce a number of policies on the basic income, taxes, and the liberalization of the market, which were seen as threats by the League and Berlusconi's Forza Italia. In fact, later on Wednesday, these two parties did not take part in a confidence vote in the Senate on a resolution backing Draghi. And the vote, as we all know, saw Draghi failing to win enough support to carry on leading the government. What lies ahead for Italy? Definitely Italy will have snap elections that could take place as early as late September. Maybe a caretaker prime minister until the elections, until the next elections, and definitely more political uncertainty. And the prospect also of protracted uncertainty is likely to unsettle financial markets. It's what most political analysts observed in the past hours. Many said that this was rather an individual choice rather than a choice made in the interest of the country. So, as usual, there are conflicting sides, and many analysts have said that the parties should have tried to find a joint solution in the interest of Italy.
Russia is blaming the U.S. for hampering peace talks with Ukraine, saying that there has been no contact with Washington over the negotiations.
The reason is obvious. It is the destructive policy of U.S. President Joe Biden, who has declared his goal as the defeat of Russia in Ukraine. The American administration forbids its team in Kyiv to even think about talks with us, and evidently forces them to fight to the last Ukrainian. What can we discuss with the United States of America under these conditions?
On Wednesday, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said the talks to reach a truce over Ukraine make no sense. Ukraine hit back, saying that Russia is not seeking peace. Negotiations to put an end to the war have come to a halt since early April. That is when the two sides held talks in the Turkish city of Istanbul. The Ukraine war began on February 24. The West, especially the U.S., has supplied Ukraine with arms and has imposed sanctions on Russia, targeting its economy. Moscow, however, says that even the harshest sanctions would never make it change course. The Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko has accused Western countries of fomenting the war between Russia and Ukraine.
You, the Westerners, have fomented this war. It's not just my belief. I can prove it on the basis of 100% facts. You have fomented the war and are continuing it. We've seen the causes of this war. The cause is that if Russia had gotten ahead of you, members of NATO, you, the Westerners, would have organized and struck a blow against it.
The Belarusian leader said the West and Kiev must agree to halt the conflict in order to avoid what he called the abyss of a nuclear war. Lukashenko said the ongoing conflict could have been avoided if the West had given Moscow the security guarantees that it wanted. He demanded that Ukrainian authorities hold talks with Russia and to agree that they will never threaten the country. Meanwhile, Moscow warns that it will stop supplying crude oil to global markets if the U.S. imposes a price cap on Russian oil. The United States says the cap would help drive down global energy prices. We have discussed the issue in depth during our news review program. Let's take a listen.
On this segment of the program, Russia has warned that it will stop supplying crude oil to global markets if a price cap is imposed on it. The announcement was made by Russia's Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak. He was reacting to a U.S. plan for imposing a crude price cap to make it harder for Moscow to sell oil and fund its military campaign in Ukraine. Novak said if oil prices are lower than the cost of its production, then Russia will not ensure oil supply to world markets. Russian President Vladimir Putin has told reporters earlier that oil prices would skyrocket if a price cap were imposed. Europe has been experiencing record-breaking inflation rates and rising fuel prices in the wake of sanctions against Russian energy imports. Moscow says the EU is about to go through a looming energy crisis due to its own bans against Russia's crude production. The Kremlin says the situation could create catastrophic consequences in the global market. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent Jerome Hughes, who's joining us from Brussels. Also, we have Yanis Koutsimidis, the European Affairs Analyst, joining us from Athens. Let's start off with Jerome in Brussels. Jerome, I'd like to get your, first of all, assessment of this warning by Russia and what kind of repercussions this could have at this moment, not just for the global market as a whole, but specifically Europe, which has been suffering from an energy crisis ever since it imposed sanctions on Moscow.
Yeah, well, what we see is a situation, you know, we heard in the sort of mainstream Western media now for weeks and for the last few days and weeks in relation to Nord Stream 1. And it was certainly, at the very best, it was implied that, you know, somehow the problem with Nord Stream 1 was being manipulated or masterminded by Russia, that this was to try and reduce gas capacity to the EU. But the reality is, of course, that even if you speak to energy experts, they say that this was scheduled for a long time, even before February the 24th. We knew that this was annual maintenance. So, you know, Nord Stream 1 is now back up and running. But if you listen as well to the European Commission, I mean, they had a press conference yesterday, Wednesday, and for more than an hour, you had Ursula von der Leyen, the head of the Commission, the Executive Vice President, Frans Timmermans, and two other commissioners talking about Russia weaponizing gas, and so to speak. You know, and of course, this is all related to the terrible war in Ukraine. Nobody in their right mind could support the war in Ukraine, although many people, including a lot of lawmakers here in Brussels, suggests that actually it was provoked by Russia, it was provoked by the West, the expansion of NATO, and Russia felt that it had to defend its territorial integrity. And so, you know, there's arguments around that. But really, you know, if the EU is accusing Russia of propaganda around the whole energy thing, well, I'm afraid to have to say it's certainly there's propaganda coming from the EU as well, because at the end of the day, Russia has it has actually kept all of its contracts for gas so far. It is true that if you look back, for example, to this time last year, the amount of gas coming from Russia into the EU has reduced considerably. But, you know, at the same time, the contracts that are in place have been fulfilled. And this is something we asked the Commission yesterday. They confirmed that. They says, look, as far as we can see, the contracts are being honoured, but you'd have to ask individual member states. But you'd have to look at it from the perspective of Russia. You know, when all of the oil coming from Russia into the EU has been banned, and the coal and other minerals, and unprecedented sanctions against banks and individuals and so on. Why would then Russia come along and say, OK, well, look, you've banned everything else, but you need more gas. We'll send you more gas. You know, so you have to look at it from Moscow's perspective as well. The contracts have been honoured. There is a pledge that Gazprom will continue to honour its contracts. But, you know, you do have to ask the question from their perspective. Why would they say, OK, we'll send you even more gas?
Mr. Koutsimidis in Athens, give us your breakdown of Russia's warning.
Well, it's been for quite a few weeks now that there is a discussion among G7 members and in the EU about a possible price cap on Russian oil. But experts are almost, majority of experts say that this cannot work because there are ways around that, because there will be disruptions and many reasons about that. So eventually, I don't think there will be a price cap on Russian oil. What I think it's realistic, it's in the coming months, there will be a reduction of imports of Russian oil to the EU, according to the agreement, to the agreement of the European Council that was taken a few weeks ago, with the exception of Hungary and Czech Republic, I think. But the real issue is the natural gas flows to Europe. We've seen today that Nord Stream 1 is starting again to flow gas. I think there is no realistic incentive for Russia to completely cut off gas supplies to the EU. What I think in the midterm and the long term, there will be a transition of European gas imports from Russia. And this is something that we'll have to see how much it will impact the European economies. There was a report 2 days ago by the International Monetary Fund that said there are several levels of impact that will hit European economies, other countries to a more extent, other countries to a lesser extent.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Jerome Hughes joining us from Brussels, and also thanks to European Affairs analyst Yanis Koutsimidis joining us from Athens. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review.
Britain's Supreme Court says that it will hold hearings in October on whether Scotland can go ahead with a second independence referendum without the consent of London governments. The top court says that it will hear arguments from both sides on the 11th and 12th of October. Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, has said that she wants to hold a referendum in October of next year. But the British government has said that it will not allow it because Scots once rejected independence in a 2014 vote. A referendum held without London's approval would not be legally binding. Sturgeon says that a majority of Scots are now in favor of independence. She says political and economic changes have taken place after the COVID pandemic and that Britain's exit from the EU. All Scots voted against Brexit in a 2016 referendum. UK consumers, meanwhile, are facing an ever higher bill for their weekly shopping, with inflation hitting a new 40-year high of 9.4%. That leaves Britain with the highest inflation in the group of seven major economies. And as Saeed Purza reports, it could get worse in the months ahead.
You don't have to be a financial expert to know your pound just isn't going that far. The price of everything has gone up. Living in the UK has become more expensive.
I've had to cut down on a lot of stuff. I can do shopping only maybe once, twice a month because finances are not that great. See, most money goes on bills, petrol, to get the kids to school, come back and, you know, make sure the house is in order because obviously the kids have to eat.
We've seen a dramatic increase in it whereby we could go and spend X amount and that would be for 7 days. We're now going, actually, that's not even covering the whole week now.
The things contributing to the high rate of inflation, soaring energy, fuel and food prices, driven by a number of factors.
Those causes are very often related to Ukraine and Putin and the war, because what we know is that has pushed up gas and electricity prices. There are also transport costs have been going up because of logistical problems following the coronavirus. Then, of course, we've got the problem of Brexit.
And the worst is yet to come. Britain's central bank has warned price rises could hit 11% later this year. but will come down in the year after. Experts say the UK could be at risk of recession.
The Bank of England's got it wrong as usual. So it will come down, but it will be much more persistent than anybody is anticipating. And to get it back down to 2% could take at least 3 years, not two, not one. And it's going to take a long time, actually, because it's now embedded in the system. And people will want to catch up. You see, the public sector, they're going to take a big real wage cut this year, probably, but they're not going to tolerate that the following year.
The government says one way to contain inflation is to suppress wages. Prices are going up, but incomes are not keeping up. That has meant sweeping rail strikes over demands for higher pay. Some public sector workers, such as teachers and medics, have received a pay rise, but below the inflation rate.
These are tough times for everybody, but it's those on the lowest incomes who are feeling the pinch. According to one study, more than 4 million, that's one in six British households, are worse off now than they were last year, a number that could change come the coal season. Saeed Purizab, London.
More protests are held in Iraq after 9 people were killed in the shelling of a Kurdish village that the government has blamed on neighboring Turkey. In Baghdad, demonstrators protested outside of the Turkish visa office despite a heavy police presence. Anti-Turkey protests also took place in the central cities of Najaf and Karbala, as well as the southern city of Nasiriya. The Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Qadhimi has declared a day of national mourning. He has warned that Baghdad reserves the right to retaliate, calling the artillery fire a flagrant violation of Iraq's sovereignty. Baghdad says that it is recalling its charge d'affaires from Ankara and has summoned Turkey's ambassador. It has demanded an official apology from Ankara. Turkey says it is not responsible for the deadly strike in northern Iraq that also left 23 people wounded. And that is for this edition of World News. That's bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration asked a U.S. judge for a 60-day extension before it formally weighed in on whether Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince, ought to be granted sovereign immunity in a case involving the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. The request comes after President Biden's return from a trip to Saudi Arabia and West Asia, in which he claims to have raised Khashoggi's murder with the Saudi crown prince. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Stephanie Kirchgassner. The piece is titled, White House Seeks to Delay Decision on Prince Mohammed Immunity Over Khashoggi Murder. The Biden administration asked the U.S. judge for a 60-day extension before it formally weighed in on whether Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince, ought to be granted sovereign immunity in a case involving the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. The Department of Justice said in a filing before a U.S. district court that It had initiated a decision-making process about whether it would file a statement of interest in the case, but that it would not be able to comply with the court's requested deadline of 1st of August. The United States is diligently considering the court's inquiry, but the process for doing so requires consultation among multiple entities within the executive branch of the U.S. government with respect to complex issues of international and domestic law, the filing said. The judge in the case granted the U.S. government its request and gave it until 3rd of October to submit a statement of interest. The request comes just days after U.S. President Joe Biden returned from a controversial trip to Saudi Arabia, in which he met with Prince Mohammed bin Salman and claimed to have raised Jamal Khashoggi's murder in a private conversation with the Crown Prince. Jamal Khashoggi, a Saudi native who resided in Virginia and wrote critically about the Saudi Crown Prince's crackdown on expression and dissent within the Saudi kingdom, was murdered by Saudi agents in the Saudi consulate building in Istanbul in October of 2018. An unclassified intelligence report into the murder released by the Biden administration shortly after President Biden took office concluded that Prince Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS, ordered the murder. Biden promised on the presidential election campaign trail to treat Saudi Arabia as a pariah state in the wake of the murder and refused to personally acknowledge the Crown Prince's role as a de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia until his recent visit. President Biden said after his meeting with Prince Mohammed that he had confronted the Crown Prince about Jamal Khashoggi's murder and suggested he told the prince that he held him personally responsible for Khashoggi's murder. But Adel Al Jubeir, the Saudi foreign minister, said he didn't hear Biden say that to Prince Mohammed. In response to that claim, Joe Biden said Adel Al Jubeir's account was dishonest. Al Jubeir also stated in a recent interview that Saudi Arabia cared deeply about human rights and maintained the official Saudi position that the Jamal Khashoggi killing, which investigators have shown was premeditated, was a rogue operation that occurred without the knowledge of Mohammed bin Salman. Attempts to hold Saudi Arabia accountable for the murder have so far failed. A trial held against unnamed defendants in Saudi Arabia was widely condemned as a sham, and Turkey recently ended its own trial in the murder. The only remaining avenue for Prince Mohammed bin Salman to face some legal consequences is in the United States, where Jamal Khashoggi's fiancée, Hatice Cengiz, has filed a civil lawsuit against the Saudi Crown Prince for ordering the killing. John Bates, a district court judge in the U.S., said in early July that he was inviting the U.S. government to weigh in on legal questions about whether the trial should go forward and whether the United States has an interest in the case. He also said he would hold a hearing on 31st of August after motions to dismiss the civil case by Prince Mohammed bin Salman and others. The motions to dismiss the civil case rest on claims by Prince Mohammed's lawyers that the Washington, D.C. court lacks jurisdiction over the Saudi Crown Prince. In his response to the government's filing, Judge John Bates said he welcomed the parties in the case until 20th of July to state their views on whether the 31st of August hearing should be delayed. For the Biden administration, it is a whole different level to go out of the way to give Mohammed bin Salman immunity in a court of law over the most documented assassination that he ever did. To give legal immunity would give Mohammed bin Salman a license to kill, said Abdullah Alouz, the research director of DAWN, a non-profit organization that promotes democracy in the Middle East that was founded by Jamal Khashoggi and a co-plaintiff on the case against the Saudi Crown Prince.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Asad Jafari.
Imam Ali, alayhi salatu wasalam, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Muhammad. He says that you are to live for this world as if you are to live for 100 years. At the same time, he says, live for the akhirat and the hereafter as if you were to die tomorrow. What does that mean? That means plan. Plan. Save your money, plan for the future, invest in a house. Look 20 years, 30 years down the road. Right? To those who are part of the Jamaat, let's say, for example, and you are the decision makers of that Jamaat. A lot of your discussions and your decisions, be it based on the fact that you invite someone like me to speak, or be it the fact that, you know, you may one day decide to move buildings, let's say, for example, all of that is with 15, 20 years in mind. In our personal life, same idea. We get married, we think to ourselves, okay, you know what? I'm going to have children, raise those kids, marry those kids off, become a grandparent. All those things are. At the same time, we are not to attach ourselves to this world such that if we are to leave tomorrow, we are ready to go tomorrow for the hereafter. Very balanced. Imam Sadiq, alayhi salatu wasalam, says that if you are to measure the level of khawf and rija, of fear and hope inside of the believer's heart, they will weigh the exact same amount. One of my favorite hadiths, I tell you. There are those people who are so hopeful, they are delusional. They continue to justify every sin that they make, no sort of presence of them trying to cleanse themselves, clear themselves up, you know, avoid that sin. No, let's keep going. Let's have God forgive me. He promised He'll forgive me. I'll keep giving Him every reason to forgive me. That's delusion. There's no way that God can forgive me. My sins are too big. His mercy it won't cover my sins, blah, blah, blah. You have no idea what I've done. Both of them are extremes. Both of them are to be rejected. Imam Sadiq says, if you are to measure both of them, you are to find the exact same amount. A believer lives on hope. A believer lives on fear as well. There are several others like that. In this discussion on the world of emotional intelligence, the maktab of the Ahlul Bayt, the school of thought of the Shias, also have asked the human being to find a moderate level of emotion. Be it your desire or be it your anger. Let's give some examples. What do I mean by this? Let's start off with those who have a deficient level of anger. Because what I want to change tonight is I want to change this perception we have of anger to be somebody punching through a wall, to be somebody just tearing somebody apart with their words, to be somebody, God forbid, physically abusing somebody, to somebody committing a crime, hurting themselves out of rage and anger, right? That's not always the picture of anger. Sometimes anger actually breeds beautiful qualities inside of the human being that's revered and respected by God. I'll get to that in a moment. Follow me. So there are levels of a deficiency of anger that irritates God. When a person doesn't have enough anger, they become a coward. Follow me for a moment. What is it that stops somebody from defending their family? Or let's go another route. What factor, what emotion is it that allows somebody to find the courage to stand up, let's say, to a bully, or stand up, let's say. Let's say, for example, you're coming home after a program at the Jamaat, and you're on your way home, and you pull into your driveway, and God forbid, you see somebody who is inside of your home, now robbing your home right in front of your eyes. The front door is busted open, you look inside, and this guy is in the kitchen just filling up his sack with all of your dishes and everything. What do you do? First of all, the first anger is rage, angry. Along with, you know, you're in shock, maybe you're a little bit scared, he might have a weapon. But the anger now will force you to say, excuse me, what are you doing in my house? Get out of my house right now. If you have the right amount of anger. And you become the defender of the home, the defender of your property, the defender of your family. But if you have a deficient level of anger, that cowardice comes in and you run. There are some people who run and leave their family right in the middle of the danger. Right? There's a fire going on inside the house and they knock everyone else down. They go straight out for the front door. Meanwhile, the wife is on the ground and the kids are on the ground inhaling smoke. But hey, you're on the front lawn and you're safe. There are people like that in this world. That cowardice is not something revered by God. There's nothing Islamic about that. Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu qu anfusikum wa ahlikum nara. O you who believe, protect yourself and your family from the fire. You have that duty, especially as husbands and men in the audience. You are the qawameen. You are the maintainers, the protectors of the household. Doesn't mean that everyone else is too weak. Oh, come and protect me. Oh, my savior. No. Allah is telling the man that you are responsible for that. Now, if the man doesn't have a certain level of anger inside of them, in terms of a level where now, when they see someone disrespecting their wife, or disrespecting their kids, or their home, or themselves, that anger breeds what? That anger now breeds courage. It's a very noble trait. So when you are deficient in anger, you become a coward. And then you become a mazloom. A Muslim in the most negative sense. That now you are the object of everyone else's oppression. You don't stand up for yourself. Someone sits there, talks smack about your wife in front of you. You don't say a word. Why? Because you're scared of them. A man now, disrespecting your wife in front of you. You don't say a single word. Why? Because he's 6 foot eight, 6 foot four, got huge forearms. Doesn't matter. Let him bruise you up. Let him break your legs. But you don't let him talk to your wife like that. A deficient level of anger causes a man who should stay there and fight to actually do what? Flight and take off. It's not revered in Islam. It's not respected in Islam. Imam Hussein stood there, 30,000 people on one side, 120 some say on one side. He knew it's going to be one-sided. Forget one-sided. He will be killed in the most brutalist ways. His submission to God, his anger for the enemies of Allah, all caused him now to be there on the day of Ashura, facing the enemy. So there can be a deficient level of anger, absolutely. There can also be an excessive amount of anger as well. When now, of course, you just snap, where you should be quiet and freeze, or you should walk away respectfully, you don't. You stay and you fight. And there are some people who, when they get angry, everything is out of control. Their tongue goes, their limbs go. They say things that they never thought they would say. They become people that other people are scared about, their own family tipping toes around them, right? One little word snap, one little event snap, right? And they just, they cause, a very difficult life inside the house for everyone around them. So there's expression there of anger for sure, but there's an excessive amount of expression where Allah says, speak to your children in a loving tone. Speak to your spouse in a soft, naram lahja, as you say. Right? Address the mu'mineen with loving terms. Even talk to your enemy with respect. But here you are, obscene language, insults that really, really dig deep. Right? Snapping at your children to the point where now you say words that echo in their minds 20 years afterwards. Stripping them of their dignity. Telling them you amount to nothing. I wish I never had you. What kind of child do I have? You're worthless. You're useless. All these things out of anger now. I'm sorry I was angry. You said sorry, no problem. But those words echo in their mind. And later on now they'll begin to rear their ugly heads. That's an excessive amount of anger. There are people I know, I'm sure all of you do too. Unless they punch something, their anger it won't get out. So you see holes all over their walls, their drywall in the house. Very common. That's excessive. Those are people who need therapy, anger management therapy. There's no way Islam condones that. And that brings me to the moderate level of anger, which I'm sure now you picked up, that moderate level of anger. If the deficient level is cowardice, if the excessive element is an animal-like behavior, that moderate level that we're all trying to aspire to is courage.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adim Alimun Halim Hakimun Matim وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the United States, climate change and rapid population growth are shrinking the Great Salt Lake, creating a bowl of toxic dust that could poison the air around Salt Lake City. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Christopher Falvell. The piece is titled, As the Great Salt Lake Dries Up, Utah Faces an Environmental Nuclear Bomb. If the Great Salt Lake in the United States, which has already shrunk by two-thirds, continues to dry up, here's what's in store. The lake's flies and brine shrimp would die off. Scientists warn it could start as soon as this summer, threatening the 10 million migratory birds that stop at the lake annually to feed on the tiny creatures. Ski conditions at the resorts above Salt Lake City, a vital source of revenue, would deteriorate. The lucrative extraction of magnesium and other minerals from the lake could stop. Most alarming, the air surrounding Salt Lake City, Utah, would occasionally turn poisonous. The lake bed contains high levels of arsenic, and as more of it becomes exposed, windstorms carry that arsenic into the lungs of nearby residents, who make up three-quarters of Utah's population. We have this potential environmental nuclear bomb that's going to go off if we don't take some pretty dramatic action, said Joel Ferry, a Republican state lawmaker and rancher who lives on the north side of the Great Salt Lake. As climate change continues to cause record-breaking drought, there are no easy solutions. Saving the Great Salt Lake would require letting more snow melt from the mountains flow to the lake, which means less water for residents and farmers. That would threaten the region's breakneck population growth and high-value agriculture, something that state leaders seem reluctant to do. Utah's dilemma raises a core question as the country heats up. How quickly are Americans willing to adapt to the effects of climate change, even if those effects become urgent, obvious, and potentially catastrophic. The stakes are alarmingly high, according to Timothy Hawks, a Republican lawmaker who wants more aggressive action. Otherwise, he said, the Great Salt Lake risks the same fate as California's Owens Lake, which went dry decades ago, producing the worst levels of dust pollution in the United States and helping to turn the nearby community into a veritable ghost town. It's not just fear-mongering, he said, of the lake vanishing. It can actually happen. Say you climbed into a car at the edge of the Pacific Ocean and started driving east, tracing a line across the middle of the United States. After crossing the Klamath and Cascade Mountains in Northern California, green and lush, you would reach the Great Basin Desert of Nevada and western Utah. In one of the driest parts of the United States, the landscape is a brown so pale it's almost grey. But keep going east. And just shy of Wyoming, you would find a modern oasis. A narrow strip of green, stretching some 100 miles from north to south, home to an uninterrupted metropolis beneath snow-capped mountains, sheltered under maple and pear trees. At the edge of that oasis, between the city and the desert, is the Great Salt Lake. Utahns called the metropolis the Wasatch Front, after the 12,000-foot Wasatch Range above it. Extending roughly from Provo in the south to Brigham City in the north, with Salt Lake City at its center, it's one of the fastest-growing urban areas in the United States, home to 2.5 million people, drawn by the natural beauty and relatively modest cost of living. That megacity is possible because of a minor hydrological miracle. Snow that falls in the mountains just east of Salt Lake City feeds three rivers, the Jordan, the Weber, and the Bear, which provide water for the cities and towns of the Wasatch Front, as well as the rich cropland nearby, before flowing into the Great Salt Lake. Until recently, that hydrological system existed in a delicate balance. In summer, evaporation would cause the lake to drop about 2 feet in level. In spring, as the snowpack melted, the rivers would replenish it. Now two changes are throwing that system out of balance. One is explosive population growth, diverting more water from those rivers before they reach the Great Salt Lake. The other shift is climate change, according to Robert Gillies, a professor at Utah State University and Utah State climatologist. Higher temperatures cause more snowpack to transform to water vapor, which then escapes into the atmosphere rather than turning to liquid and running into rivers. More heat also means greater demand for water for lawns and crops, further reducing the amount that reaches the Great Salt Lake. And a shrinking lake means less snow. As storms pass over the Great Salt Lake, they absorb some of the moisture, which then falls as snow in the mountains. A vanishing lake endangers that pattern. If you don't have water, Dr. Robert Gillies says, you don't have industry, you don't have agriculture, and you don't have life. Last summer, as the water level in the Great Salt Lake reached its lowest point on record, and it's likely to fall further even this year, the lake's surface area, which covered about 3,300 square miles in the late 1980s, has since shrunk to less than 1,000 square miles, according to U.S. Geological Survey. The salt content in the part of the lake closest to Salt Lake City used to fluctuate between 9% and 12%, according to Bonnie Baxter, a biology professor at Westminster College. But as the water in the lake drops, its salt content has increased. If it reaches 17%, something that Dr. Baxter says will happen this summer, the algae in the water will struggle, threatening the brine shrimp that consume it. While the ecosystem hasn't collapsed yet, Dr. Baxter says, we're at the precipice, and it's terrifying. The long-term risks are even worse. One morning in March, Kevin Perry, a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Utah, walked out onto land that used to be underwater. He picked at the earth, the color of dried mud, like a beach whose tide went out and never came back. The soil contains arsenic, antimony, copper, zirconium, and other dangerous heavy metals, much of it residue from mining activity in the region. Most of the exposed soil is still protected by a hard crust. But as wind erodes the crust over time, those contaminants become airborne. Clouds of dust also make it difficult for people to breathe, particularly those with asthma or other respiratory ailments. Dr. Perry pointed to shards of crust that had come apart, lying on the sand like broken china. This is a disaster, Dr. Perry said, and the consequences for the ecosystem are absolutely insanely bad. In theory, the fix is simple. Let more water from melting snowpack reach the Great Salt Lake by sending less water towards homes, businesses, and farms. But metropolitan Salt Lake City has barely enough water to support its current population, and it is expected to grow almost 50% by 2060. The worst-case scenario for the Great Salt Lake is neither hypothetical nor abstract. Rather, it's on display 600 miles southwest, in a narrow valley at the edge of California, where what used to be a lake is now a barely contained disaster. In the early 1900s, Los Angeles, growing fast and running out of water, bought land along either side of the Owens River, then built an aqueduct diverting the river's water 230 miles south to Los Angeles. The river had been the main source of water for what was once Owens Lake, which covered more than 100 square miles. The lake dried up, and then for much of the 20th century, it was the worst source of dust pollution in America, according to a 2020 study by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering and Medicine. When windstorms hit the dried lake bed, they pick up PM10, particulate matter 10 micrometers or smaller, which can lodge in the lungs when inhaled and has been linked to worsened asthma, heart attacks, and premature deaths. The amount of PM10 in the air around Owens Lake has been as much as 138 times higher than deemed safe by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. Local officials successfully sued the city of Los Angeles, arguing it had violated the rights of nearby communities to clean air. A judge ordered Los Angeles to reduce the dust. That was 25 years ago. Since then, the city of Los Angeles has spent $2.5 billion trying to keep wind from blowing dust off the lake bed. The city has tried different strategies, covering the lake bed in gravel, spraying just enough water on the dust to hold it in place, constantly tilling the dry earth, creating low ridges to catch restive dust particles before they can become airborne. The result is a mix between an industrial site and a science experiment. On a recent morning, workers scurried across the vast area, checking valves and sprinklers that continually get plugged with sand. Nearby, inside a complex that resembles a bunker, walls of screens monitor data to alert the operation's 70-person staff if something goes wrong. If the carefully calibrated flow of sprinklers is disrupted, for example, dust could quickly start to fly off again. Dust levels near the lake still sometimes exceed federal safety rules, among Utah's coterie of nervous advocates for the Great Salt Lake, Owens Lake has become shorthand for the risk of failing to act quickly enough and a grave damage if the lake dries up, the contents of its bed spinning into the air. Of what used to be shore of what used to be Owens Lake is what's left of the town of Keeler. When the lake still existed, the town of Keeler was a boom town. Today it consists of an abandoned school, an abandoned train station, a long-closed general store, a post office that's open from 10 a.m. to noon, and about 50 remaining residents, who value their space and have lots of it. Cheap land, said Jim Macy when asked why he moved to Keeler in 1980. He described that period before Los Angeles began trying to hold down the lake bed as the time of dust. He recalled watching entire houses vanish from sight when the wind blew in. We called it the Keeler Death Cloud, Mr. Macy said.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the text of the speech delivered on June the 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of the top officials and employees of the judiciary. Agha Beheshti was in charge of the administration of the Revolutionary Council even during the lifetime of the late Agha Teleghani. He was an outstanding personality. May God exalt his rank by his grace. I would like to take a quick look at the situation during that time in this gathering. These events are something for us to learn from. Taking into consideration the situation that existed 41 years ago on June the 28th can be enlightening. First of all, in those days, the imposed war had created the worst, most difficult situation. Saddam's regime had brought its forces close to our large cities in both the south and in the west. Some of the cities they had taken control of. In some cities such as Ahvaz, Dezful, and some other cities in the west of the country, their forces had come close to those cities.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
During the first months of the year 1360 AH, that's 1981 AD, in April, May and June, I was in the western region of the country. I won't forget. I mean, even now, while I am talking to you, the effect of the grief that had spread over the region at that time is still in my heart. A cloud of sorrow had spread over the whole western region. This could be seen wherever a person went. One day, we were passing by these mountain heights, which were known as Baraftab, and which are close to Kermanshah. As we were driving in the car to go to a specific point, not even one step of this long way was safe. There was the possibility that the enemy's artillery or mortar shells would be dropped there at every moment. The enemy had surrounded that area to this extent. The environment throughout the area was truly sad. The enemy's forces were skilled. Our forces were unprepared. Our facilities were extremely limited. They had abundant facilities. Our army brigade in Ahvaz needed to have about 150 tanks, for example. But I think we had about 30 or 20. I do not remember the exact number. We had about this many tanks. This was our situation. This is about the war.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.